We're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
Worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
Good afternoon. Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on Media Channel Radio, talking about media issues with the people who are involved in the media, who have a lot of experience to share, and who have a lot of critical insights that grew out of their careers and their work in the media. And joining me today, Eric Tate Jr. Eric worked with me at ABC News, but he worked there much longer than I did. He was in the World News headquarters. In the newsroom, he covered stories all over the world. He's also a member of the National Association of Black Journalists, and it does a program about media criticism here on Manhattan Cable in New York City. What better person than to talk about what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri, and all the other Ferguson, Missouri stories that we only find out about after someone is shot to death by police in a situation of clear overreaction. Eric, tell us a little bit, if you will, what you were going through when you heard about this story.
You're speaking about Ferguson, which is currently the high-profile story in our local and national news. Correct, Danny?
Correct.
What bothers me is when I heard about Ferguson, it just gave me another sickening feeling in the pit of my stomach, because it just meant another black male was gunned down by our, quote, law enforcement agencies, who are supposedly here to serve and protect. But in the instances where they patrol, and I mean that literally, where they patrol the African-American and other communities of color, they're not there to serve and protect. They are there as an occupying, invading force. And so that sickening feeling meant that the status quo, what's happened to us over and over historically for 400 years in this country, is continuing to happen. And so, yeah, basically it triggers not just a sense of sick and tired despair, but there is the corollary where there's a lot of anger that starts to roil inside.
You know, and particularly after we've been through several a month now of this war in Gaza, an area that is occupied, an area that was being, you know, bombed to the ground and being destroyed, with an occupying attitude but of people who felt that they should control what was going on there. You compare Ferguson, Missouri, and the Ferguson, Missouris in our country to occupied areas. I don't think most people see it that way. Why do you?
Well, the interesting thing, Danny, is, you know that old saying, for evil to triumph, good people must remain silent. That's a paraphrase, but you know where I'm coming from.
Oh, sure I do,
We've got a new mantra here because of this quote war in terms. If you see something, say something. Well, I like to flip that on its end and say, if you see something like the kind of criminality that's going on in Gaza, and that is actual criminality, as you articulated yourself, and as other people have, they're not getting as much play as they should, but it is a crime that's being committed. If you see it, you should say something about it. You should speak up about it. You should articulate that it is indeed a crime, and then you should try to do something about stopping it. We are the taxpayers whose dollars are continuing to funnel, I guess, the last influx of money with something like $225 million or more, replenishment of the arms and the munitions that the Israelis are raining down on the people of Gaza. We need to speak out about that kind of wanton support of that kind of criminality.
But there seems to be a parallel here with the militarization of our own police, as the Pentagon gives away tanks and other weapons associated with war to local police officers who now begin to take on a kind of warrior attitude. They now have, the tanks and the gear so that they see themselves even more like an occupying force.
That's not accidental. They actually have been propagandized into that kind of thinking. It started long before the war on terror, okay? It's been documented. There's a book out now. I'm getting one of these senior moments where I can't pull the author's name, but he actually chronicles the actual transformation of the police departments in this country, where they went from the guy on the beat with his baton, not necessarily being the pistol being the first thing he reached for. In the old days, he'd reach for that baton and sort of threaten somebody with it and move about the community and knew the community. And they went from that role to a more armored SWAT mentality long before the, quote, war on terror. But the war on terror then gave the impetus for militarizing and passing on these kinds of military equipment to these police departments. And the federal government poured a lot of money into the militarization of these police departments. So that becomes a different kind of mindset. Now, when you couple that kind of police SWAT mentality to your local police, and you couple it with the fact that they don't even look like or represent physically, psychologically, racially, the communities they're policing, you then get into this us against them mentality. The population isn't coming us against them. It's the occupying force that's bringing that us against them mentality.
Now, you've been in the newsroom for a long time. You've seen how these issues are handled, not only at the network level, but across the country and in the media. And so what happens when an incident like this, we usually don't hear about any of the underlying problems until there is an incident, until somebody is dead. Then they suddenly start doing a kind of post-mortem, looking at, what happened and how could this happen. We saw that during the riots in the 60s with the Kerner Report. We saw that in many other instances where it wasn't until afterwards that people realized what the police were doing and what, local government was doing was encouraging the confrontation and the polarization in the culture. But you're in the newsroom. What happens when somebody calls this in? What happens next?
So actually go back to what you just mentioned, the Kerner Commission, right? Kerner Commission grew out of all those urban disturbances in the 60s because the population just got tired of the inequities, social inequities, criminal justice inequities, economic inequities. And what the rash of incidents that kicked off all those things were usually some form of police brutality in a community, and the people just got sick and tired, so they just rose up. So when the Kerner Commission was formed and they did their report, they basically said, you got two Americas here, and the two Americas are not representative of each other, and the people that are policing that other America are seen as an occupied force, and so you have a recipe for disaster and a recipe for more of these urban uprisings. Mm-hmm. Now, because of that, during those urban disturbances, the major networks and most newspapers, they really have people of color to send into those communities to cover those stories because none of them had any people of color on their staff, and the community was just up in arms about anybody who didn't look like them coming in. They'd be stoning anybody that didn't look like them. So all of a sudden, the newspapers and the media companies said, we need to find some people. I came out of a military, okay, in the late 60s, and ended up being interviewed by all three networks, and as you well know, ended up at ABC News. I was one of the few and one of the early blacks in network television because they were in, I don't want to say a panic, but they understood that they were not able to cover those communities because they didn't have people that came from those communities. So there's your first stepping stone. So take for my example, for example, I might be in an editorial meeting in one of those newsrooms, And I might say, you need to be over here because I think that's what's going to break next. Well, if I don't have a person who kind of looks like me or at least understands my background, that I came out of the military and I came out of wherever my educational background was, and that I'm somebody who they should be listening to, just the nature of my skin color make them try to dismiss me out of hand. So even when you're inside, you still have to actually ring three bells for them to pay attention to then listen to you.
Well, you know, now, at the time, just to break in for a second, you know, at the time of the Kerner Commission indicted the response to the urban uprisings in the 60s, but it also indicted the American media. Now, that part of their report was barely covered in the American media, but it's
well,
there.
What do you expect?
But it was there, and it indicted the all-white news media.
Yes.
It indicted the lack of sensitivity, the lack of awareness, the lack of background, and what have you. And it not only, you know, indicated that one reason we had sort of two countries in our country was because of this communications gap.
That's correct.
Now, some of the
correct.
Media...
And it's not just racial, because there was another, I guess, survey done, and basically white, poor communities actually had similar gripes about the fact that their communities were not being properly covered,
and
not
Latinos
being properly
as well.
Served. And guess what? That's not much changed today.
Well, I hear it has been changed, though, Eric. I hear there are actually fewer blacks working in the media today. And not only that, but the black press, which had always been out there to, you know, cover some of these stories, itself has had a hard time surviving in this era of media mergers and all the rest of it. And so it's become more of an entertainment media than a news and information media.
Okay, you touched two points, Danny. The high point of minorities, I quote, call people of color minorities, but you know what? They basically are the dominant population in the country now, or will be in 2 years.
Right, exactly.
But people of color, let's just say, high point in mainstream media was, I believe, 1984. From 84 on, the numbers have been decreasing. Now, numbers in newsrooms across the country, print and broadcast, have all been decreasing with the advent of the Internet. And so what you're getting is a constriction of the number of people covering news. Once that constricts, the people of color constricts even more because light runs to light. So the people of color get let go disproportionately. And so within the decimation of newspapers and not enough diversity in the broadcast rank, the black press, newspapers, magazines, they're suffering just like the other print media. And because they're not as healthy, they tend to go under faster. They have even though some of them have been hundreds, at least 100 years old, those 100-year-old outlets are now either trying to make a new life for themselves online or have just folded. And so this constriction is affecting coverage of real news across the board. And so you know what's happening. If it's affecting,
you know,
our community, it's also affecting your community.
Well, you know, back in the day, as they say, back when I worked I was in the civil rights movement in Baltimore, Maryland, The Afro-American newspaper was covering stories every week that the Baltimore Sun didn't even know existed, didn't want to cover, even though Baltimore was becoming a majority, black city. And, you know, this is a pattern around the country where a lot of the journalists who are the most knowledgeable about a lot of these issues are not getting opportunities to work in mainstream, so-called mainstream media.
Danny, they're not getting the opportunities on the new, quote, media either.
Okay, well, let's make that point,
online
too.
Online media outlets, they're very reluctant to release any of their numbers pertaining to who's working for them. And when they bring them out, they're abysmally worse than the mainstream media.
Right. I know that Jesse Jackson just had a campaign with Twitter and forced them to reveal their very unequal employment practices.
The numbers were just so bad.
You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, is it partly because people, we're in a post-racial world, people are not conscious of this or don't want to be conscious of it? What do you attribute this to?
Danny, you're being facetious when you say we're in a post-racial world,
well,
right?
I'm being facetious to try to encourage you to explain this a little bit more to our audience, because I don't think, you know, if you're not in a situation of, you know, of oppression, if you will, you're not as sensitive to it as the people who are.
Well, you know, you talked about it earlier. Now, the parallel between Ferguson and Gaza is even, there are other people who have made this comparison before. Gaza, the West Bank, what Israel is doing to Palestine is exactly the same as what South Africa was doing to the black population with their crazy Bantustans, their free townships and all that crazy gerrymandering they do to have people carry passbooks, have to go from here to there. You got to show some kind of that. That's what they're doing to the Palestinians. It is a horrendous. They're like in an open-air prison, okay? Other people have phrased it that way.
Well, maybe
I need to let the rest of the people understand that they're not getting a true picture of what's going on over between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Well, maybe that's why, you know, over 100,000 people in Cape Town protested against, you know, Israeli abuse in Gaza. I mean, this is the biggest demonstration probably in South African history, even bigger than when Mandela was released from prison.
Because they infinitely understand exactly what the Palestinians are going through, because it's so similar to what they went through.
But, of course, the Israeli lobby dismisses this totally. Aren't you aware that there's a, you know, a Arab in the parliament in Israel and blah, blah, blah? You know, I mean, they have a whole bunch of message points to obscure this.
Danny, do you see the correlation of they have an Arab in the parliament to they have a black man in the White House? You see that parallel?
Well, it's not that far-fetched. Now, here's Obama today, President Obama, giving a talk about all this and, you know, trying to be very balanced in his response. You know, there's no excuse to attack police officers. There's no, on the other hand, there's no excuse for the police to be, you know, to use undue force. And he did make that statement. And there are civil rights investigators from the Justice Department finally on the scene there. And the governor of Missouri has now put the state police in to replace the local police. Not that the state police
has
such a great reputation.
The state police dealing with people of color. So is that going to be any better?
Well, I can't think so because...
Well, okay, let's wait and see. But let's get back to President Obama and his statement. President Obama, for me, is, I think we had a discussion way back when, before the second term. I mean, you did Media Watch, my show, a few times, and I'm pretty sure we
was kind of enthusiastic
before the run-up to the 2008 about whether President Obama was a liberal, a centrist, a moderate, or whatever, right? And I know we had this discussion because, based on his own words and his own history, you could tell that this is a guy who believes in collaborative consensus building. He does not believe in any charge forward,
adversarial,
wherever the chips may fall, as long as I think I'm right, that's where I'm going to go. That's not his makeup. It never has been. And so it doesn't surprise me. Even in his second term, where he has not to worry about any reelection, he's still going to have this consensus-building approach. As someone else stated, I think it was one of the Facebook postings, so this president is calling for calm. Why the hell isn't he calling for justice? And that's a very valid point. It's okay to call calm, but your stress should be on, let's get to the bottom of what the heck happened that's causing these people to be so upset, because this is a repetitive pattern. And as the president with the bully pulpit, he should make use of it. Even if they might want to say, well, he's being black because it's a black kid. Well, guess what? It's a kid who got killed under very trying circumstances. Just because you're not a black president, just because you are a black president, or maybe not, you should be able to speak to the issue of that.
When you talk to, I know that you speak at conferences and you're out in schools talking to young people in your community and other communities. What is your reading of the, you know, approach that young people in your community take towards the media. Do you find a lot of interest in being in the media or a sense of being excluded from it?
Actually, I'm working with a group of young people in the city of Mount Vernon in a media center that I helped founded with the city of Mount Vernon. And part of my mission is to get them to be media literate, get them to understand how the media covers their community and why they should be in that media covering their community so that people like them are represented on air, behind the scenes in the decision-making process. Because the bottom line is, if you don't have someone in the newsrooms of this country, whether it's one of these online news organizations, one of these aggregators or whomever, who says, no, you cannot say something like that, or are you people taking a look at how these police forces are responding to these communities without provocation, with all these armored vehicles and armored personnel and camouflage outfits? They look like an invading force, and nobody's done anything to warrant that kind of show of force. If you don't have somebody saying, you need to be reporting that part of the story, and I don't think that part of the report came out till, what, yesterday?
You know, I always wondered this, and let me ask you this, because how did you cope being in that, in the, if you will, the insane asylum of ABC News? You know, they used to say that CBS is like the church, NBC is like the Vatican, is an institution that's extremely controlled from the top, and ABC was more like an insane asylum. But what? How did you cope there, being in those meetings with people who, you know, often didn't know what you were saying or why?
Yeah, the bottom line is there are two things that you and I both learned. Know your stuff and be willing to back up your stuff, okay? And we've had to go to the mat with executive producers about certain issues on stories we did for them where we had to say, no, you can't use that lead-in because if you do, that's going to skew the story and you might find yourself in court. Somebody else might rewrite your lead and you have to say, don't do that. Of course, I had to do that on a couple of occasions for 2020 lead-ins. But here's the thing. You are the person. Say, when I was on assignment desk, I used to run the foreign assignment desk for those people, right? Okay? This was before I came over to 2020. And I'd be saying, you need to be over here, or I need to be over there. Perfect example. I don't know how much time we got, but you remember when Pakistan split?
Yeah.
Okay, so you had East Pakistan, West Pakistan, and what became Bangladesh was the stepchild of the Pakistani immigrant. And so I was on the, before I was in the foreign assignment, I was on the night shift, and all these telexes from Agence France-Presse and AP and UPI were coming in, and this one Sheikh Mujibur Rahman was saying, no, we're not taking this any longer. We're sick and tired of this. And he was having demonstrations day in and day out. I kept reading that, so I thought, damn, this thing's going well. So I kept telling my manager every evening, I said, you got to move Ted Koppel out of Hong Kong, put him in there. And he just said, anyway, yeah, look, you know, there's nothing going on. I said, every night. It took me 4 days. I finally convinced him. Now, I'm talking to Koppel. I'm saying, hey, this thing looks like it. He said, yeah, I've been kind of watching it. I said, I'm going to try to get him to move you. He said, let me know. And so when I finally convinced him, they moved Koppel. I said, if you don't move him now, when it breaks, you can't get in. So we moved Koppel. Koppel's in East Pakistan, and he's filing these background reports and their crate reports, and Evening News is using them, and but after 3 days, nothing happened. So the news manager says to me, hey, get him out. Get him out. He's on my budget. And I said, you, if you pull him now, when it goes, he said, yeah, you said it was going to go. Well, it didn't go. I was supposed to send him a telex, and I kind of sat on the telex. Fortunately for me, it blew, and so I didn't get fired.
You know, my story, just briefly, you know, I was in Southern Africa, in Zimbabwe, actually, at a time when South Africa was actually attacking Zimbabwe. And I asked the president there, I said, you know, would you welcome American planes to, you know, resist against the South African attacks, okay? And he says, you know, nobody has raised that before. Yeah, of course we would. We need that kind of help, okay? So
right.
I said, have you told anybody else this before? He says, no, nobody asked me ever, okay? So I said, well, That's very good. So if I can get a crew here to cover this, would you be interested in talking to them? He says, yeah, sure I would. So I called ABC in New York, your old desk there, the foreign news desk, and I said, I'm calling from Zimbabwe, and this is an interesting story because nobody's covering this attack by South Africa on the so-called frontline states in Southern Africa, et cetera, et cetera. And the response was this, that was just shocking to me. He says, where is that? Okay, where are you? You know. I mean, they had no. It wasn't on the radar screen. It wasn't even in their heads. There was no awareness of it. And you know, this is a whole.
If they don't have somebody with a little bit of smarts on geopolitics and just plain geography, they find themselves kind of out in the cold. Well, you know, I had enough background on geopolitics and recent Far Eastern politics in the Far East and in the subcontinent, and I knew that thing was going to blow. And
you were right.
For them, just, I was right.
Well, we're running out of time. Eric, we're running out of time. Just one last thing here. Which way would you like to see the media go with this story of in Missouri? What should be reported?
The first thing is all those media organizations should descend on their en masse and not let the cops tell them they can't cover a story. This bit about no-fly zones and you can't be here covering a story because we say you can't, that's a police state. They need to challenge that on the spot.
And obviously, we've got to get deeper into not just the militarization of the police, but the criminalization of the black community in so many places and the incarceration of the black community in numbers that, you know, are staggering.
Danny, that's like eight different stories, and it all goes back to the residue of slavery, Jim Crow. That's the mindset, the non-first-class citizenship that black people have been working to come out from under for 400 years. That's another whole story that nobody talks about. But, you know, Sam Pollard's Slavery by Any Other Name, my series, Then I'll Be Free to Travel Home, all that historical stuff has been documented. News people need to dig into it and show the relevance to today's stories. That's what they're not doing.
Eric Tate Jr., formerly with ABC News, someone I've known and respected for so many years. Thank you for joining us on Media Channel Radio. Please check out the podcast when it goes online, and also give us some feedback of issues that you think need to be raised on this program. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Make sure you come on Media Watch.
I will do that. No question.
All righty.
Danny Schechter, your news dissector here. Joining me now from Los Angeles, California, from Hollywood itself, one of the actual film writers and historians who I respect a great deal, Ed Rampell. He's written widely in a number of publications. You've probably read him in The Progressive and a lot of other outlets. He's extremely knowledgeable about not only the culture and history of Hollywood, but also the way it's being covered and miscovered. And I've invited Ed on to discuss the recent death of Robin Williams, which has gotten unlimited coverage in every outlet because of its how sad it was and all the rest of it. And then later, the death of Lauren Bacall, the model turned actress who really galvanized, you know, a whole generation of moviegoers and the like. As you observe all of this, Ed, what's your take on the coverage of it? How deep did it go, or does it go?
Aloha, Danny. Thanks for having me on. Well, first of all, of course, I'd like to extend my condolences to the families and the loved ones of Mr. Williams and Ms. Bacall. I'm not sure where to begin. Let me start with an important observation for our particular listeners regarding Lauren Bacall, which is that what I have not heard in any of the biographies given of her on the air is the greatest role she played, which was, by the way, off screen. In 1947, when the Hollywood blacklist was rearing its ugly head, Bogey and Lauren Bacall and Katharine Hepburn and John Huston, William Wyler and others participated in an organization that was called the Committee for the First Amendment. And they actually chartered an airplane, flew cross-country, and attended the hearings of the House Un-American Activities Committee in Washington, D.C., in opposition to the growing blacklist that was engulfing Hollywood. So it's very interesting that her shining moment in terms of progressive politics is just completely forgotten, just completely overlooked. It's not even worth mentioning. And when she and her husband, Humphrey Bogart, took this stand publicly, it was a very courageous thing to do. And by the way, Bogey was in two films by screenwriter John Howard Lawson, Sahara and Action in the North Atlantic, which were World War II movies. But they were very, very politically savvy, politically conscious, anti-fascist movies. In fact, Action in the North Atlantic actually took Bogart to our Soviet ally. He was a merchant marine man in the movie, and bringing supplies to the Soviet Union. And John Howard Lawson became one of the Hollywood Ten, and he was reputedly the quote-unquote cultural commissar of Hollywood branch of the Communist Party. So I think that our listeners really need to remember Lauren Bacall and put that into context.
Well, there have been no shortage of of photos of her as a model, of beautiful she looked, and all the rest of it. Commentary about her grace and her bearing and her style and everything else. But the substance of what she actually fought for and believed in was sort of written out of the history by the news media.
Yeah, completely overlooked. She was very beautiful. I don't think that they're mentioning that she was Jewish. And, you know, Humphrey Bogart was not Jewish. And that was kind of a courageous thing to do in the 1940s, to have an interreligious marriage, which was not as common then as it was now. And we don't think of quote-unquote Jewish girls in the light of how Bacall was portrayed. She was a model before she became an actress, before Howard Hawks and so on discovered her. But that was her brightest, shiny moment. If you go online, if you do a search for Lauren Bacall and comma Hollywood blacklist, you'll see great photos of her marching with Bogey in the streets of Washington when they went to attend the HUAC hearings.
So, you know, isn't this, though, unfortunately typical of media coverage, particularly of Hollywood, where the underlying ideas and the issues that, you know, kind of affect and influence what movies get made, what don't get made, what stars do what, and all the rest of it tend to get, you know, kind of, in a way, brushed out of the news.
And at the same time, we get to see lots of film clips of Robin Williams entertaining the troops overseas, so that they'll play up.
Yeah, but he was also pretty profound as a social critic.
But is that being played up? I don't think so. There is mention of his charitable work with comic relief, with his partners Whoopi Goldberg and Billy Crystal, and how they raised tens of millions of dollars for the homeless and I think to fight AIDS. And there is mention of that, and that was sort of Robin Williams at his finest. Do you have this? I believe when Robin Williams played the shrink for Matt Damon in Good Will Hunting, I know that Matt Damon has dialogue about Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. And I think it's to Robin Williams where he makes these comments. I won't use the expletive deleted, so to speak, that Matt Damon uses, but he says something such as, hey, if you want to read a really blankety-blank book, you should read A People's History of the United States. You know, do you see that clip on TV?
Not very much. In fact, Howard Zinn may have been one of the most popular historians in the United States, but he never got the respect from either academia or the media, certainly, that he deserved. And, you know, this is all too typical. Fortunately, Matt Damon and his partner grew up in Boston, grew up near Howard Zinn, and knew him as young people were influenced by him.
Well, I do want to interject one thing, which is that he, meaning Zinn in this case, may be overlooked by mainstream media, but right now at Scotland's Fringe Festival, there is a bioplay about Howard Zinn that's being performed at one of the four top venues at the Fringe Festival,
which
is the largest theater festival on earth, as far as I know. And it's called The Time of Our Lives, The Life and Times of Howard Zinn by playwright Bianca Batagorian. And to its credit, the Jewish Daily Forward ran my interview with the playwright a week or two ago. People can find it online. If you Google something like Ed Rampell, Zinn, it should take you to it. And so at least this play is taking place. It did get a 5-star review in an outlet in Scotland. Amnesty International has nominated the play for an award. And so Howard may be ignored by MSM, but at least the Forward had the courage to do an article about Howard Zinn, and there is this play that the playwright lives in L.A., and the plan is, of course, to take the play and perform it back in the United States, but they premiered it at the Fringe Festival in Scotland.
Well, I mean, right now, obviously, we have a media that has gone from newsbiz to showbiz, or has merged newsbiz and showbiz, so that a story like the death of Robin Williams, shocking as it was, a suicide. Now we understand that he may have had Parkinson's disease, that he had a lot of, you know, things that he was coping with and dealing with, and maybe not getting support and help with. Becomes, you know, the major media story with endless clips and interviews with fellow comedians with great entertainment value talking about him. But meanwhile, wars in Gaza, Ukraine, or even in Iraq tend to get buried more and more for this kind of entertainment, these entertainment values. I saw it emerging when I worked at ABC News at 2020, where entertainment-oriented programming was very pervasive. I saw it in the coverage of, you know, the Iraq war, and I wrote about it in my book, When News Lies, about militainment, you know, the fusion of the military and entertainment as a way to make what was going on more palatable to the American public. And there is in Hollywood an undercurrent of, you know, real kind of sucking up to the military and even to the CIA.
Well, a number of things about that. You're absolutely right, and you've been at the forefront of chronicling this as the News Dissector. It's true that what happened in the immediate aftermath of Mr. Williams' untimely death, that he dominated the cable news coverage, that is, stories about him. And this has to do with something that I'm sure that you're very, very familiar with, and you just touched upon, which is that at some point, I think it was in the 80s, and correct me if I'm wrong, the news division, the wall between the news divisions and the entertainment divisions at the outlets began to blur, if not collapse. And this further became intensified with the cable, quote-unquote, news channels. And so what you have is more of a merging of entertainment with news. So what better way to capture audiences, et cetera, than to do an entire, quote-unquote, news program about a celebrity because of his untimely death and so on. Like, for example, Lawrence O'Donnell, almost his entire show, and I think for more than one night on MSNBC, was consumed with coverage of Robin Williams, and one could argue at the expense of other more pressing and newsworthy. Not to say that Mr. Williams' death is not newsworthy, but it's the way that it is covered that I find problematic.
As now, you know, there was an incident in L.A. where the local ABC affiliate sent one of their news choppers over his house, even as his wife was saying, please give us privacy, please don't be invasive here. And they later apologized for that coverage. His daughter said that on Twitter she began getting these extremely foul comments about her father and pictures of her father and all the rest of it. And in fact, two sites were thrown off of Twitter, or two, you know, people on Twitter were detweeted because of the way that, you know, they really offended the family deliberately. And so there seems to be a lot of this one-upsmanship, you know, where celebrity exploitation has no bounds.
True, and talk about nitwits, so to speak, and social media, which doesn't have gatekeepers, competing with more established mainstream media, and there are plus and minuses to both sides that we can go into. Something that you touched upon earlier has to do with the Pentagon and the intelligence community impact here in Hollywood, the belly of the entertainment beast. And people should realize that the Pentagon actually maintains offices in Westwood, not far from the UCLA campus. I understand, and I could be wrong about
this. I wonder if they were flooded out recently when that water main went. I don't know.
Well, they're very high up in a high rise, so I don't think the water rose quite that high. It's my understanding that in one of the high rises at Westwood, there's an entire floor that the Defense Department's publicity apparatchiks own and that they operate out of. And basically, they and to a lesser extent, the CIA and probably other intelligence agencies have a quid pro quo going with the entertainment industry. And I should hasten to add that, to my knowledge, the CIA, which does have an entertainment liaison officer, to my knowledge, they do not, unlike the Pentagon, maintain an actual office right here in L.A. Their office is there at Langley, Virginia, at CIA headquarters. But here's the
problem. Well, if they were there, they wouldn't tell you where they were, Ed. But, you know, one of the things that seems clear, you look at a film like Argo, you know, this not only kind of glamorized a CIA official, you know, project there, but also was given assistance by the agency. And as does the Pentagon provide assistance, including, you know, arms and use of weapons and all the rest of this for Hollywood movies.
Well, in fact, that's the plot of Argo. That's what Argo's about. That the CIA unites with Alan Arkin and John Goodman, who play Hollywood producers, filmmakers, etc., And that's the plot of Argo, that the CIA collaborates with Hollywood in making an appearing to make a bogus film in order to free the hostages held by Iranian militants. Now, this is viewed as, from the liberal point of view, as, well, this is the good CIA, whereas the CIA in Zero Dark Thirty, where they torture, that's the bad CIA. But both films benefited from cooperation with intelligence agencies, and it should be pointed out that for the very first time, now I'm a film historian, I wrote Progressive Hollywood, I just co-wrote the Hawaii movie and television book, plus two other movie history books I co-authored. And as a film historian, I can tell you with certainty the following thing has never happened in the entire history of the Academy Awards going back to the 1920s. The winner of the Best Picture Oscar was announced by a sitting First Lady right there in the White House. And who does she give the award to but to a CIA movie, Argo, as Best Picture, while she's surrounded by uniformed U.S. military personnel in the White House.
So they're not criticizing the CIA. They're celebrating the CIA.
Well, absolutely. And the CIA is very actively, and other intelligence agencies, I suspect, very actively trying to repair its very damaged public image because of things like the drone warfare, because of things like the Snowden leaks that Glenn Greenwald and others have been bringing forward and so on. They're trying to create a public relations bonanza with TV shows. I think it's on the AMC channel. I think it's called Turn, which is about spies during the American Revolution. They're going back to the 18th century to defend espionage. And by the way, in the very first episode of Turn, set around 1776, 1777, they had an instance of what was more or less waterboarding, and it was justified. I mean, it's just incredible, all the propaganda that's coming out.
That sounds like it would make a good film itself, actually, the story of the CIA's involvement in Hollywood. I mean, that has yet to be done. Maybe you can help do it. I mean, this is a set of issues that don't get much attention in the entertainment sections, which increasingly are about what movie is coming out, when it's going to come out. Here's the trailer for that movie. Here's who's starring in it. He just had a divorce from so-and-so and all the rest
of it. And the box office, as if how much money a movie costs and how much it, quote-unquote, earns at the box office and so on, is the most important thing about a work of reputed art. It's a very bourgeois conception of the arts. I guess it has to do with what Marx called the commodification, the fetishism of commodities, the commodification of culture. It's a very interesting phenomenon, how important the box office is, when that really is kind of irrelevant to the artistic merit.
Well, it's all part of the market-driven nature of our society, and the media that plays that up. You know, what company is buying what company? Who's got a big hike in salary? Who's being fired this week? All of it consumes a tremendous amount of ink, if you will, in the press and on TV. There are whole channels that do nothing but cover this sort of thing.
And now, Danny, can I point something out to you that nobody has mentioned whatsoever in the media? There's a Showtime series about Masters and Johnson called The Masters of Sex. And this is about, it's kind of a bio series, loosely based, I suppose, to a greater or lesser extent, on the real doctors, Dr. Master and his assistant, Virginia Johnson, who was a major contributor to that, those studies on human sexuality in the 1950s. It's an excellent series. And on Sunday, the series, which takes place, get this, in St. Louis. What has happened is that Dr. Masters has been basically excommunicated from two white hospitals. So he's doing his sex survey out of a segregated black hospital, and the series makes these very interesting comparisons between racism and the persecution that these anti-puritanical sex researchers face. It's very interesting.
So it could, be set in Fullerton, Missouri, and everything will come full circle here.
That night is the riot at Ferguson, Missouri. And I thought that that was remarkable, that there's a TV series talking about racism in the St. Louis area, and then that night there's a race riot, quote unquote. Amazing.
Well, you know, of course, but you know, who calls attention to this in the media? Very few people.
Very few.
If they're
very
even
few.
Conscious.
That's our job.
If they're even conscious of it, you know, which usually they aren't. And this is one of the problems and one of the reasons, Ed, that I wanted you to join us here on Media Channel Radio, because you have been following the cultural dimension of politics, which is often the way most people get introduced to some sort of consciousness. I don't know if it's really very high consciousness or political consciousness, but it's through movies, it's through TV shows, it's through music to some degree that they hear about things that they don't necessarily hear about, certainly in the news, where they're supposed to hear about these things. And, I think that's why the looking critically at what Hollywood does and doesn't do, what role the entertainment industry plays and doesn't play, is very significant. I just read, for example, that the Democratic Party is depending on the Hollywood magnates to come up with the money to try to help the Democrats keep the Senate, you know, find the funding to go up against the Republicans. So, you know, the entertainment industry is playing a very important political role as well as a cultural role.
Absolutely. It's very fascinating. And, you know, it's my understanding that Obama basically did not campaign for president in California, which he took for granted that he'd win, which he did win. And but what he does is he comes to California only when he needs money to do fundraisers. Nothing to do with our issues in this state, and he always creates gigantic traffic jams, which local people here enormously resent. Could you imagine if Barack Obama got on a plane and flew to Missouri from Martha's Vineyard? Can you imagine that?
Yeah, well, we haven't seen that yet.
No.
But you know, in Los Angeles, traffic jams are like permanent parts of living, you know. And, you know, if you make it worse than it already is, which is often pretty bad,
absolutely,
I'm sure the public is not too thrilled about it.
Absolutely.
Adrian Pell, what are you working on now? What are you writing about?
Well, thanks for asking. If you look at the current issue, the Robert Barron issue of the Progressive magazine, you'll see my interview with Matt Taibbi. The September issue has my feature story about Dear White People, the great new quote-unquote post-racial campus comedy that's coming out soon. And also in the September issue is my interview with America Ferrara, who played Cesar Chavez's wife in the biopic called Chavez and was also the star of the Ugly Betty series. Those two stories should be in the September issue. And now I'm writing for the Honolulu Star Advertiser, a piece on this great new book by Sven Kirsten called Tiki Pop, about the American pop culture version of Polynesian arts and culture.
Well, mahalo, Ed Rampell. Thank you for joining us on Media Channel. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector. Please stay with us. We'd love your comments as well to dissector@mediachannel.org. See you next week.
To Chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank.
thank you very much for being here. Our program is on PRN, Progressive Radio Network. These interviews on the media, about the media, also appear on MediaChannel.org, the leading media issues network. Welcome your comments on both and your feedback when you can find some time to share it with me. I'm Danny Schechter, News Dissector. Email dissector@MediaChannel.org.